Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we are discussing the COVID crisis in Brazil, abortion restrictions in the United States, and the upcoming Supreme Court decision. This is very important. And the Oakland School Board's decision to eliminate its police force. We begin in Brazil, the second country in the world after the United States to register more than 50,000 COVID-19 deaths. The country now has more than 1 million cases and is tragically recording 1,000 deaths every day. Experts say the number could be much higher. Like Donald Trump, Jair Bolsonaro said the virus will pass. Joining us to talk about the latest is Kiriatana Freeland, a freelance multimedia journalist based in Rio de Janeiro, and she joins us now from Chicago. Hi, Kiriatana. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. After the United States, Brazil is registering the highest number of COVID cases and deaths. And according to a New York Times database, if the trend lines hold, epidemiologists project that the death toll in Brazil could surpass the United States by late July. And it's so tragic to think that 1,000 people are dying every day. Can you give us the latest? Where are the hot spots?
So, as you can tell by these numbers, the virus is spiraling out of control, and this is mainly due to a lack of policy. So, I mean, in essence, their hotspots are all over the country. But what is happening is that the less fortunate, the impoverished, Black people, poor people, people in the north, which is a more underdeveloped area of Brazil, indigenous people, those are the people who are suffering the most. So the data says that, you know, coronavirus has probably touched 75% of the municipalities in Brazil, but it's within those municipalities, it's who it's affecting us that who's really being affected the most.
Right. According to a UN report, Black people in the state of Sao Paulo are 62% more likely to die from the virus than white people. As you said, the same for indigenous communities. The death rate is double the rest of the country. Given the frightening rise in the number of infections, what are you hearing from epidemiologists about what's going to happen in these communities?
Well, let me explain to you how this happened. So the virus actually arrived in Brazil through people who are more well-off, people who were able to travel, people who were traveling in Italy and France over the carnival vacation. And when they came, they spread the virus to the people who are impoverished, people who work for them, whether it be domestic servants or doormen. And what happens is these particular people, once they caught the virus, they obviously took the virus to their communities. And the communities were impoverished people. People in Brazil live tend to be favelas, which we know are very, you know, close-knit communities of people where people live in, multiple people live in small houses or in the periphery, which is you know, on the outskirts of poor communities, on the outskirts of large communities. And what is happening is that these communities could not properly social isolate the way that more well-off people could socially isolate. In addition, within these communities, many people live day-to-day, meaning like what they earn for that week or what they earn for that day is what they're going to spend that day. So it was also impossible for many people to just, you know, sit in their home and not do anything and not earn money. And so what you had is you had less social isolation in these communities, and these communities are less served by the state health system, and they're thus likely to, you know, go to the hospital early on when they catch the virus. It tends to be later on. In addition to just people having more illnesses at the same time. So what we have is the virus is actually in effect killing more Black people, killing more brown people, which would be considered pardo people, killing more poor people. And actually also, if you're, the studies have shown that if you're uneducated, if you have a lower level of education, that you're more likely to die from the virus. When it comes to the indigenous people, within Brazil, indigenous people mainly live in the north. And the north is the most underdeveloped part of Brazil. And we know that indigenous people tend to live in communities that are far from major health centers. So when an indigenous person falls ill from the virus, it often might take them a half day to a whole entire day to arrive at a health center. So this community obviously is being ravaged by the virus because, you know, they live in small communities, and some of their leaders, their caciques, have already passed away from the virus. Mm.
It's so heartbreaking. I saw a couple stories about how the people who hold the knowledge in the indigenous communities are dying, which is devastating to these indigenous tribes. Vice had a very good report out yesterday, and they report that the virus is spreading to the most remote parts of the country. More than 300 indigenous tribes in the Amazon region are vulnerable. And in some of these very remote communities, COVID is wreaking havoc. As you said, the planes are bringing sick patients to the hospitals. And it was so awful just to see people say, we live in a remote society. We don't like to be in contact with people. So this is all very scary to be in this hospital. And then they're kind of surrounded by this plastic little cave almost because they're so sick.
Yes. And also another thing to add is, and I know we're probably going to talk more about Jair Bolsonaro, but the first thing that he did when he came into power is that he ended a program in which Cuban doctors served very remote indigenous communities. In these communities, this is the first time they'd had a doctor that attended to them. And so what we have happening is that, you know, people don't have, in these remote communities, people don't have medical people to serve them. And so obviously they have to travel far to get that medical attention.
Why did he end that program?
Well, in Brazil, Cuba represents communism, and Bolsonaro came in to power on a platform that he would not allow any form of communism in Brazil. And so wanted to kind of symbolize what he was planning to do, one of the first things he did was basically end what was an incredibly successful program. The program called Mais Médicos, this program was so successful that infant mortality decreased significantly in areas that were served by Cuban doctors. And that included many indigenous areas that previously had not had medical attention.
Kira Tiana, the similarities between Bolsonaro and Trump are pretty striking. As you're telling me about him getting rid of this Cuban doctor program that really helped indigenous tribes, I'm thinking that the Trump administration is urging the Supreme Court to reveal the Affordable Care Act, as this country is now seeing infections spread and we're breaking records almost every day now.
Yeah, and I think there's so many similarities in the way Trump and Bolsonaro have handled this crisis. First and foremost, just not really having a plan and not sticking to a strong communication to the whole entire country. When it comes to Bolsonaro, you know, he's really made fun of the virus. He's called the virus the little flu. He's even had protests. You know, about 2 months ago, he would joined kind of the anti-government protests. When I say anti-government, I mean like anti-Supreme Court and anti-Congress protests in support of Bolsonaro. He would join these protests where people were not wearing masks. And so he's literally belittled his health ministers. Over the course of 3 months, Brazil has gone through two health ministers who did not disagree with the way Bolsonaro wanted to manage the virus. And so now Brazil actually doesn't even have a health minister. There is an interim health minister who is technically an army general who is managing Brazil's coronavirus crisis.
According to the New York Times, Bolsonaro said yesterday that he might have contracted the coronavirus. He said he has tested negative twice, but he fought a court battle to stop the release of the hospital tests, raising questions over whether he may have been infected or not.
Yeah, there, you know, the media in Brazil, there was a time about 2 months ago where many people thought that he had already contracted the virus, because when he actually visited President Trump on, you know, in a meeting in Florida, the majority of his circle contracted coronavirus. And, you know, it was a tug of war in trying to find out, okay, did he really contract the coronavirus? So, this is the way that Bolsonaro is really just playing with the media. We'll probably will never know if he had the coronavirus, but we do know that he has not handled this well in a way that prevents deaths in Brazil, because the deaths are spiraling out of control.
Two of his health officials have resigned. Has this affected his base of support at all?
That's a great question, because as of yesterday, Bolsonaro still has 40% support in Brazil. And obviously he has this like very strong support that is unwilling to let go. But one of the things that the surveys have revealed is that his support is actually increasing among poor people, because the government has been giving out has provided the poorest people with kind of auxiliary funds to survive off of for the last 2 months. So Brazil is in a really strange situation in which they have a president who is obviously failing at managing the coronavirus, but the president still has significant support.
So he was elected in 2018, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's been in office for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. Have many things changed for the poor over those 2 years?
Well, since former President Dilma Rousseff was impeached in 2016, there's been a significant increase in inequality in Brazil. In addition to just the economy in general, you know, once if the economy does not improve, meaning like GDP, if the GDP doesn't grow, the people who are affected the most are the poorest people. And so these are the people who have seen their incomes decrease over the past 2 years since Bolsonaro came in. And so, like I said before, it was really interesting to see that his support level still remained pretty, you know, constant at 40%, even though the economy was even not doing well before the coronavirus. Obviously, with the coronavirus, it's doing even worse. And when it comes to, I can't say that the lives of the most impoverished in Brazil have improved since Bolsonaro has entered office. Mm.
Today we are talking about the COVID-19 crisis in Brazil with Kira Tiana Freeland. She's a freelance multimedia journalist. She's going to be with us for about 5 or so more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments specifically about what is happening in Brazil, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Kira Tiana, here in the United States, because the federal government is really not doing anything about COVID, in fact, the Trump administration wants to decrease funding for testing. So it's really falling on states and local governments. And of course, every governor has a different plan. You know, some decided to really take it seriously from the beginning, others didn't. And now they're, you know, changing their plan to reopen in places like Texas. So what is it like in Brazil? I mean, how are people getting information? How are they making really important decisions?
So when the crisis first hit, most of the governors of the states were all aboard in terms of, you know, implementing social isolation and really communicating to the public that social distancing was the way to go. And to an extent, Brazilians went ahead and did that. Obviously, but what happened was the governors had a conflict. Most of the governors, the governor of Sao Paulo, the governor of Rio, which are the largest states in Brazil, conflicted with Bolsonaro, because Bolsonaro did not want to close the economy. Obviously, he was appealing to people who could not socialize, isolate, just because their living depended on actually going out in the streets every day. And so, you know, in those first 2 or 3 months, Brazilians were receiving so much conflicted information. You know, the states would emphasize social distancing, and the governors would obviously emphasize social distancing, but the president himself would be out in the streets, you know, handshaking with people and talking with people without a mask. And what has happened is that, as you know, in the U.S., social isolation and social distancing will only go so far if you don't implement massive testing and et cetera. And so what's happened is that these governors find themselves at the point where they have to open the economy. They cannot prevent people from staying in their houses any more longer, just because people need to earn a living. And so many people, you know, in addition to just people being tired of sitting in their houses, many cities, like, let's take, for example, Rio de Janeiro, is seeing the movement of their people based on the cell phone data skyrocket. In fact, the rate of contagion is, I think, about 1.3. So each person who has coronavirus is infecting more than one person, which you don't want that to happen. You want the rate of contagion to be less than one. And it was actually less than one in May when everybody was properly following social isolation. So similar to the U.S., in which there's some governors who are doing their own thing, some governors following Trump's lead, Brazil is very similar in that, you know, governors try to go their own way, and if there's not a national plan, then, you know, eventually social isolation just gives way to just people wanting to be on the streets and people having to make a living.
Exactly. The same is happening here. Before we let you go, Kiritiana, I want to ask you about the protests that are happening in Brazil against police brutality and racism. You tweeted video of two women telling police to get off of what looks like a teen boy who is black. The women actually got on the ground and tried to physically get the police off of this teenager. You write that this is an everyday occurrence in Brazil.
Yes, see, in Brazil, police violence is kind of accepted. It's normal. In fact, just to throw out a couple of stats to you, on average, the police knowingly kill about 6,000 people in Brazil each year, which is about five times the number that American police kill. And so, you know, this issue with police violence is something that activists take on every day in Brazil. It's never not an issue. And in actually, right when the murder of George Floyd happened, there was actually some digital protests happening in regards to another 14-year-old who was killed at the hands of police, João Pedro. What is happening, and there were actually physical protests on the street, but what is happening is that these activists who are mainly black, who mainly live in favelas, this is where the police violence takes place, you know, they're at a point where the virus is really, you know, spiraling out of control, so it's really difficult to expect people to protest every single day and every single week in Brazil. So there were protests, but perhaps not as large, definitely not as large and expansive as the protests were in the United States.
The Financial Times reports that racial inequality is very much alive in Brazil. 56% of the country's 211 million people define themselves as black. Brazil is the world's second largest black population after Nigeria. Final thoughts? The similarities are just really striking. Sadly, where do you see this going with the protests happening and then the COVID cases spiking in Brazil?
I think that Bolsonaro is going to continue to do what he feels personally is right for Brazil, which obviously many of us don't agree with. And I actually think the only way that there will be some significant difference in what happens in regards to social inequality and even perhaps coronavirus is if the U.S. has a change in their own government. I think that we can attribute much of the success of Bolsonaro being elected to the fact that the United States elected President Trump. And so if indeed President Trump loses the elections, And perhaps, you know, obviously Joe Biden comes in and kind of has a different relationship with Brazil and presents kind of a different model of a country, because unfortunately, and you know, I love Brazil and I've been living there for 5 years. Brazilians still look to America as to kind of like how to model their country, how to model themselves personally. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like if America can present a different model, then things will change in Brazil.
Wow. Well, Kara Tiana, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Kara Tiana Freelon is a freelance multimedia journalist who is based in Rio de Janeiro. She was joining us from Chicago, and you can find more information about the work that she does at yourcallradio.org. Now we are going to talk about how Republicans in the United States are exploiting the COVID pandemic to restrict access to abortion across the country. We'll also get an update on the Supreme Court's first major ruling on abortion rights. Now I'd like to welcome Melissa Jeltsin to the show. Melissa is a senior reporter at HuffPost, where she covers domestic violence and other issues related to women's health, safety, and security. Hi, Melissa. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's first talk about this landmark abortion case that the Supreme Court is slated to rule on next week. It's the case June Medical Services versus Russo Centers. It's about a 2014 Louisiana state law requiring doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges with a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic. And that allows a patient to go to the hospital if urgent care is required. Can you tell us more about this case and about this law?
Yeah, so the admitting privileges requirement is something that they put in place so that the doctors who are providing abortions have the approval to go into hospitals and admit the patients there. But the fact is that that really rarely happens. Abortion is such a safe procedure that it is in the only very extreme cases that patients will have to go to a hospital. And if that's the case, the doctor doesn't need admitting privileges. Of course, anyone is allowed to go to the hospital in an emergency situation. So these admitting privileges requirements are very difficult for doctors to get if they're not typically admitting patients, because they're really business agreements with hospitals, right? So if you're not admitting patients, hospitals don't want to give doctors admitting privileges. So we've seen this be passed in other states, and generally the impact of such admitting privilege rules is that doctors who provide abortions can't get them, and it's just another way that clinics are shut down because they don't have doctors who can fulfill this requirement. All the leading medical groups say that this is an unnecessary requirement. It does nothing to aid women's health and actually harms it, because then you have less doctors who are able to provide abortion care because they simply can't get the admitting privileges requirement met.
And according to reports I'm reading right now from an ABC story, when Louisiana native Kim O'Brien decided to have an abortion in 2011 because her pregnancy had severe complications, she was unaware of the difficulties she would face, including traveling to another state. 9 years later, O'Brien is part of a case before the court that has the potential to dramatically change the landscape of abortion across the country. She's a mom of two daughters, and she decided to tell her story publicly and join the case as an amicus curiae or a friend of the court, because she doesn't want women to go through the same thing that she went through.
Yeah, I mean, right now there are only three clinics left in Louisiana, and so this law that the Supreme Court is currently weighing in on, if it is upheld, people who brought the suit believe that there will only be one clinic left in the entire state, and so access will be severely diminished. But it will be very interesting to see how the court does decide, because they already took a very similar case in 2016 with a nearly identical law in Texas. And in that case, they decided that that law was unconstitutional because it did not aid women's health and it was only harmful. And so they said that Texas could not keep their admitting privileges law. So it would be very shocking if they do uphold the Louisiana law, and it could have wide ramifications across the country in terms of states passing laws that really impact women's ability to access abortion.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about the piece that Melissa wrote, the inside story of how Arkansas exploited COVID to stop abortions. We're joined today by Melissa Jeltsin, senior reporter at HuffPost, where she covers domestic violence and other issues related to women's health, safety, and security. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're speaking with Melissa Jeltsin, senior reporter with HuffPost, where she covers domestic violence and issues related to women's health, safety, and security. So we talked about that very important Supreme Court decision that will come down next week. Let's now talk about your piece, The Inside Story of How Arkansas Exploited COVID to Stop Abortions. States are using the pandemic to shut down the few clinics that have been able to keep their doors open. You write about what's happening in Arkansas, which only has two clinics left. Can you give us a little background? How did Arkansas get to the point of having only two clinics?
Well, over the past few years, once the state legislature went red, they have passed some of the most restrictive laws in the nation. They have a 72-hour waiting period for women seeking abortions, which means that you have to make two trips to the clinic and have space in between them. And now that there are only two clinics left, that means driving often hundreds of miles, very far, having to get childcare twice, having to take time off of work. But all of the restrictions that have been passed have really had the effect of making it incredibly difficult to get abortion and also forcing people to leave the state to go to surrounding states to get care. I decided to look into Arkansas for this story because as the coronavirus pandemic began sweeping across the nation, we saw a number of states determine that abortion was a non-essential service. They decided it was, not an essential medical procedure and it could be delayed. And we saw this in states that have historically been really hostile to abortion, like Texas and Arkansas. And so there was a lot of media coverage of those decisions and the quick impact on clinics who had to shut down, but I hadn't seen a really a comprehensive deep dive into how a state actually made that decision and what different players were involved and where the pressure was coming from, which is how I came to my story.
As you report, from March to May, governors in 12 states determined that abortion was not an essential healthcare procedure, triggering widespread confusion and some temporary clinic closures.
Yeah, so in Arkansas, they decided soon after Texas that their clinics, the abortion would be a non-essential procedure, and they sent a cease and desist order to the one clinic in the state that still provided surgical abortion, so any abortion beyond 10 weeks. But what I discovered through looking through Freedom of Information Act requests was that a lot of pressure on the clinic, on the Department of Health to close the clinic was actually coming from a longtime anti-abortion protester who for almost 10 years had stood outside the clinic and protested the clinic. But 2 years ago, the Republican governor appointed her to the Board of Health. So in this position, she had a lot of power. She had the cell phone number of the leading attorneys at the Department of Health. And so, she really spotted an opportunity once coronavirus came to Arkansas to exert a lot of pressure on the Department of Health to close the clinic. And that's exactly what ended up happening.
So this is 68-year-old Catholic pharmacist Marcia Boss. As you said, and as you report, she's been trying to shut down the clinic, the Little Rock Family Planning Services, since 2008. She has been organizing anti-abortion protests at that clinic, rallying church members to participate in 40 Days for Life campaigns, and recruiting volunteers to pray outside its doors year-round. What else can you tell us about Marcia Boss?
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't able to speak with Marcia. I did reach out to her, but she did not want to do an interview. But what happened in Arkansas has happened in other states, right? So we've seen anti-abortion protesters and people who it is their mission to end legal abortion get appointed to positions of power within state health agencies, so departments of health. And, we've seen a lot of media attention over the past few years on state legislatures and anti-abortion bills that they pass, and so that sort of gets a lot of attention. But behind the scenes, state health departments actually have immense power over abortion clinics. In Arkansas, they set all the rules and regulations for the clinic. They can walk in at any moment to do an inspection, and a single violation can cause them to rescind the license. So they have a ton of power in determining whether an abortion clinic is going to make it or not. And we've also seen the rise of what are called trap laws, which is targeted regulation against abortion clinics. These are laws that set really stringent requirements on clinics that other types of doctor's offices don't have. So like the exact size that the waiting room is, how many extra bathrooms you have to have, the size of the hallways, these sort of explicit rules around what the physical dimensions of the clinics are, and they're not usually medically necessary, but they're people who are in support of abortion rights will say that these laws are generally passed under the guise of protecting women's health, but actually intended to close clinics. And, you know, in Texas, we saw, you know, half of their clinics close after a similar law was passed.
You write that Marsha Boss often intercepts patients as they pull into the driveway, handing them literature through their car window and imploring them to turn around. This is according to a security guard that you interviewed over the phone. Sometimes she would wear a white lab coat or scrubs, perhaps a nod to her pharmacy degree. But since she was not an employee, the uniform had the potential to confuse patients. So she does that at the clinic. And then, as you write, as a board member, she actually takes part in quarterly meetings where she voices her concerns about the state's abortion facilities. So one day she's out basically telling patients to turn around and she's handing them literature and a lab coat. And the next day she's taking part in these board meetings.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, it looks like it's an unethical, position for her. I mean, she clearly has her mind made up that abortion is not not an acceptable thing. It's something that should not be allowed, even though we know it is a constitutional right for women. So she has, you know, has a clear perspective, but then in her role at the Board of Health, that's really about maintaining and protecting public health. But, you know, women's right to access abortion is part of public health. So it that was sort of my interest in the story, was showing how it really matters who governors appoint to these positions, because they have a lot of power over the public health decisions in the state. And, you know, my story gets into this a little bit, but really we do not know the consequences of all of these clinics being shut down and having to stop providing services during the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, the a number of women who had to travel out of state to get care. I interviewed one woman who drove hundreds and hundreds of miles crossing two states after Texas shut down their clinics, and had to go on this sort of crazy road trip with very little money, having to, you know, go into gas stations in fear for her life while we had, you know, this was in the beginning of the pandemic when we didn't really know much about how it spread. And that was just to get a medication abortion. So literally just to pick up the pills that she needed to, she had to drive, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles because Texas shut down their clinics. So, and those are people who were actually able to get abortions, who sought them. There's obviously many women who were not able to during this time and were forced to continue unwanted pregnancies. And so it's, you know, it's going to be a long time till we fully can reckon with what happened to reproductive care during coronavirus. And so that was sort of the point of my story, to say, like, hey, we need to pay attention to the decisions that were made and what kind of profound impacts it would have on women's lives. Because obviously, saying that abortion is non-essential, it is a time-sensitive procedure. You can't just put it off for 3 months and do it later. And that's what many states said. And so, you know, hopefully I'll be able to continue reporting on the impact of these choices as time goes on.
So here we are in 2020 with COVID cases really breaking records, and women are having to drive across states to just get an abortion pill. And as you said, in extreme circumstances, women are forced to have children. Is there any possible way, how, as a reporter, how are you able to get this information to quantify this?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly difficult because abortion is a really private matter. Some people might experience shame around it. Their other family members might not know about it. So, yeah, as a reporter writing about this topic, it's even been hard for me to find people who were seeking abortions during coronavirus to speak with. And luckily, I have been able to reach out to a few of them. But I would hope that there are researchers who are going to dedicate some real time to looking at the impact on reproductive care during COVID, because I think it's a really, really important story. And the clinic director in Arkansas, who's really like in charge of making sure that this clinic does not shut down as the only, you know, remaining surgical clinic in the state under attack by state legislators, by protesters, by their own government. You know, she knows of herself. She knows two women who personally wanted an abortion, really needed an abortion, wasn't able to get one and missed the legal cutoff and are now, you know, continuing their pregnancies to term, pregnancies that they really didn't think that they could afford or could not, did not have the capacity to handle. And that's just that she knows off the top of her head. And we, this happened in many states. So the toll is immense.
Final question, Melissa. The abortion rights organizations and advocates have lost so much ground on this issue. One of the main reasons is gerrymandering. There are a lot of other issues, conservative Democrats in these states. But where do you see this going at a time when the Supreme Court is going to make this decision next week? And then we're just seeing restriction after restriction at the state level. And unfortunately, because of the COVID crisis, I mean, your piece is excellent and thank you for writing it, but this is just not getting as much attention as it usually would.
Yeah, I think that the Supreme Court decision next week is really going to send a powerful sign about where we're going to go with this issue. I mean, they have a chance to say, you know, it's curious, right, that they took this case after pretty decisively saying that these types of laws were unconstitutional when they ruled in 2016 on the Texas law. So the fact that they're taking this case again, you know, they could come out and say, no, states cannot pass these laws that are clearly just intended to make it harder and harder for women to access abortion and don't have any medical benefit. And that could have, you know, a real cascading effect in other states that are trying to pass these same laws. So it could have a really positive effect if they come out with something forceful like that. Or they could go the other way, and it's really up in the air, and it's, you know, I don't want to make any predictions about what's going to happen, but I think we'll have a better sense once they decide that that's going to send a signal to the rest, to all the state legislatures, who I would also add, in the last 2 weeks, three states have passed anti-abortion legislation in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Two of them did it in the middle of the night, you know, when the public wasn't there and able to listen in. So they're not stopping this attack. I think people are, anti-abortion groups are emboldened by Trump's presidency and they believe, and the, you know, two new conservative justices, and they think that this is their time to overturn Roe. So the attacks are ongoing and it will be really, really interesting to see what happens with the Supreme Court case next week.
Well, thank you so much for your reporting. Thank you for joining us. We will definitely do an entire show on this issue in the near future, and we'd love to have you back.
I'd love to come back. Thanks so much.
Melissa Jeltsin is a senior reporter at HuffPost, and I hope you can take some time to read her very lengthy, in-depth piece, The Inside Story of How Arkansas Exploited COVID to Stop Abortions, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Now we are going to talk about the Oakland School District's decision to defund and disband its police. And now we are joined by Ashley McBride. Ashley reports on education equity for the Oakland side. She covered the 2019 Oakland Unified School District teacher strike as a breaking news reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Hi, Ashley. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. As you report on Wednesday, the Oakland School Board unanimously voted to dismantle the 67-member police unit by the end of the year. Oakland Unified has its own police unit. Why does the district have its own police force? Can you give us some background on this?
Sure. So the police force in Oakland Unified School District actually has a pretty long history. It was established back in the 50s more as a security force, and they just responded to vandalism and smaller crimes on campus. And over the years, it expanded to become more authoritative. And in the 90s, the police department actually collaborated or partnered with the Oakland Police Department and expanded to be a lot larger. In the mid-2000s, the school district eliminated the police department because they didn't have the money for it anymore. But the way they did it, they ended a contract right after they had signed it with the union. And so the union sued and the police department was reinstated. And that's why we have the department that was just eliminated on Wednesday.
And what stands out for you in terms of how this police force operates? Which schools are they mostly concentrated in? Anything stand out for you?
Well, one thing that I think people have a misconception about is that the armed police officers that were part of the force, there were just 7 armed police officers. The majority of the personnel were school security officers. But the armed officers were not stationed at any particular school. They would just get called out. And so now that that department is eliminated, the school district will be relying on the Oakland Police Department to respond to those calls. So I think a lot of people think that the officers were stationed there, and now that they're not, there's going to be an uptick in crime. But that's not really how it worked.
Have you spoken with any students about their reaction to having police and sometimes armed police on campus?
Yes, I've talked to several students. There's actually 2 students on the school board. They don't vote, but they have been very outspoken about this issue. They feel extremely intimidated about having police, armed police, responding to their campuses. And it's really a unique kind of situation because there's really not any other institution that you go into besides a jail where you have police, you know, monitoring you like you do at school. And so they feel really relieved about this decision, but they know that there's still more work to be done.
Mm. Yeah, we would love to have some of these students on because, I mean, what is it like when you're going to school and you see police officers on the campus? You write that the vote was the culmination of a years-long campaign by the Black Organizing Project, a community organization, and OUSD families to remove police from schools. The Black Organizing Project-led campaign was given new energy by all of the protests that we're seeing against police violence following the killing of George Floyd. Tell us more about this group and the work that they've done.
Right. So their campaign got started back in 2011 after an Oakland police sergeant, shot and killed a 20-year-old named Raheem Brown. And the officers involved, there were no charges ever brought against them. But the family did receive a wrongful death lawsuit. But that event really catalyzed the Black Organizing Project to remove police from schools. And they have said back then that no one was really supporting them. No one really thought it would happen. There was a lot of resistance. And they've really been kept up with this campaign over the years and finally thought that this moment, catalyzed by the George Floyd protests, really could be the one that could get them across the finish line and reach their goal.
So the Oakland School District spends $6 million on the police force. Is that $6 million a year?
Yes. So in their budget, they spend about $2.5 million on the sworn police officers, which includes 7 officers, 2 sergeants, and the police chief who oversees the department. And then the school security officers who are unarmed, there's about 40 to 50 of those. They make up about $4 million in the school's budget.
So $6 million at a time when I've been thinking about the teacher strikes. We've had teachers from Oakland on the show talking about low pay, how hard it is to make ends meet, the desperate need for social workers, counselors, librarians, just, you know, basic positions that you would expect in a wealthy state like California.
Right. That's included in the resolution, how the district has laid off restorative justice counselors, laid off other school resources for students, but continue to spend money on this police department when they could, you know, spend less money and rely on the Oakland Police Department. That's the position of the board member, Roseanne Torres, who sponsored the resolution.
What are you hearing in terms of how, I mean, what will this look like? What happens from here?
So the resolution, along with eliminating the police department, it initiates a community-driven process where the school district will invite the Black Organizing Project, other community groups, families, teachers, everyone involved to contribute to what the school, the new safety plan will look like for schools without police. One question that remains is how involved the police department personnel will be in creating this safety plan. They still have a contract with the school district through past December 2020, which is when they're going to be eliminated. But community members have been pretty adamant that they don't want any involvement from the current police department. So it remains to be seen how the district will work that out.
Will that $6 million go to these programs?
Yes, the resolution does direct the superintendent to find, to redirect those funds to restorative justice coordinators, school counselors, school psychologists, people who support students.
As you report, the news in Oakland is part of a larger national reckoning with the role of police in communities and schools. San Francisco and West Contra Costa districts also voted to end their contracts with local police departments. Peralta Community College District's Board of Trustees voted to end their contract with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. But other districts have rejected proposals, including Chicago Public Schools and Los Angeles Unified. And I just did a quick search. I mean, this is happening all over the country. WBUR Framingham considers requests to eliminate school police officers. Let's see here. There's more. Philadelphia schools. The same thing. No more police in Philly schools. Safety officers and new uniforms coming this fall. In Las Vegas, we are not criminals. Group seeks to defund school police in Clark County. I mean, this seems to be happening really all over the country at this point.
It really is. I think it's become a lot more popular in the past few weeks because of the protests that we have seen following the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis. I think it was just something that people didn't realize. If you didn't go to a school where there were police on campus, it's just not something that you realize is happening to students. And so I do expect that this issue is not going to go away.
What are your thoughts about the media coverage of this? I mean, the basic question is, why are police on school campuses? And then, of course, the answer would be, well, sometimes kids, I heard this on NPR the other day, sometimes there are school shootings on a campus. Okay, why are there school shootings on a campus? Well, then there's the issue of guns. And poverty is also a huge issue that needs to be discussed. What are your thoughts about just how the media overall are reporting on this and digging a little deeper to talk about the underlying issues?
Right. I do think a lot of people, when they hear that there are police on campus, their immediate thought about that is, okay, well, then they need to be there, obviously, because students commit crimes. But that's really not what's happening. A lot of supporters of removing police from campus say we can reinvest these funds and respond to students' social emotional needs so that they aren't committing crimes on campus or getting involved in assaults or having access to weapons. And they think that the police issue is really a symptom of larger social issues affecting students.
Right. It seems like now that we're having this conversation, we need to take it further and really talk about why schools are so underfunded and why there are so few resources for so many children across this country.
Right. And another issue that has been brought up, one of the Oakland school board members, Jamoke Hinton Hodge, she was initially pretty resistant to removing police from schools. One of the reasons was she felt that the Oakland school police officers receive special training to deal with youth in crisis that Oakland police officers might not receive. But she's also spoken about how eliminating the police department is just one piece of reducing students' interactions with the criminal justice system. And so she feels that there needs to be more work done to address why teachers feel the need to be calling police on students in the first place. because now it will just be Oakland police officers responding instead of school police officers. And so one of the things she did was added an amendment to this resolution that board members and school staff receive implicit bias training as a way to address that.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Ashley McBride is a reporter for Oaklandside. They describe themselves as a small but mighty team of local journalists working for Oakland. They amplify community voices, share the power of real information, and investigate systems, not just symptoms. And you can find Ashley's piece about the Oakland School Board voting to defund and disband the school police at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping the studio running. And you can find more information about the show and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
The following is a test of the emergency alert system. This is only a test.